It's the work show and it's vacation time. Oh, this is going to be good. Let me see. Oh, no. I'm Paul Smart, your host for The Work Show. Today we are speaking with Bonnie Maranca of Catskill in New York City. Bonnie is a former president of Free 103.9, which is the mother organization for WGXC-FM. She's an academic and a scholar, a writer, a publisher. We were talking with her about the idea of the working vacation and how time away in certain fields actually fuels the rest of the year's work. How does your work year operate?
Well, that's a good question because the work year is different throughout the year. It's never really very steady. I consider the really stable work part of the year from the new year, like during the winter, until the spring. You know, I'm in New York City most of the year, and I don't come back and forth to my place upstate, so I'm only here between mid-April and mid-November. So that's a little bit different when I'm going back and forth. It's not the same thing as being at home with your own library, you know, in New York City, and having all the, you know, certain kind of research materials around and libraries like that. So that's a different kind of work time where I can really sort of, you know, dig in and work steadily, and also it's the middle of the year and I'm working very much on my editing. And my work is very different because it's in different areas. There's the teaching where I'm a professor of theater at the New School. Then there is my editorship and publishing as the head of the PAJ Publications and editor of the Arts Journal, PAJ, a journal of performance and art, in which I'm involved totally in a hands-on way running the business of publishing a journal three times a year and books. And then there's my own writing and schedule for lecturing and other kinds of activities and events that I do, sometimes in American universities, but usually in the May or June period in Europe. So my work is divided among those three areas. So obviously between September and May is the school year, where I put my attention into my seminars, and also I'm constantly working on the publishing because there are books to get out and there are three issues a year. And my own writing, I tend to, over the last 10 or 15 years, do mostly in the summers when I'm not teaching, though I'm still editing at that time.
And how did you... This you all planned out from a very young age, right? Just so it would work like this.
Well, things evolve. I'm not an obsessive planner. I'm very organic in a way, and things come to me naturally. It depends. If I have a deadline, I might have to work. Years ago when I was working on big anthologies, I would work on them throughout the year. There are only certain projects you can work on in the summer when you're not in your main place with your library and files. It depends on the kind of research. It depends on the kind of project. For example, in the Hudson Valley, living here, and having a house here since 1979, it's a long, long time. And I remember maybe one of the first books that I can recall working on here was actually not my theater work, but it was the kind of anthologies I do in between working on my serious essays in the arts. And they're probably cultivated around hobbies. So I worked here on a book called American Garden Writing, which actually was published by Penguin, and it became a garden book club selection. And it actually grew out of my becoming a gardener in the Hudson Valley and becoming very interested in ecology and the environment. So for that book, since it included texts from the 17th century to the present, I found myself at that time in the mid or late 80s going back and forth all the time to the State Museum in Albany, where they had these incredible old books from the 18th and 19th centuries. And then there were a lot of used bookshops between here and Albany and over toward Chatham. So I would do the rounds and go to a lot of old bookshops and buy old garden books. And so I did all that research and writing up here. When I worked on my Hudson Valley Reader around 1990 or so, again, it was constituted of material that had to do with people who lived in or traveled through the valley. And so there again, I was using libraries in the area, historical societies. I would go to Olana for research, to the Livingston House, to the Roosevelt House. So I would see what kind of papers like at Claremont were available, or Olana, looking at image research, going down to Montgomery Place. So I would spend a lot more time traveling around the valley, seeing what was available, and working on that book. All the while, also, I always work on the winter issue of PAJ here, because it has to go to press in October. So usually I'm working around July and August editing and copy editing, which is what I'm doing now. I'm in the midst of preparing material for our October deadline of going to press, and then the journal will be out you know, in January. So there's always that. And now, as we're coming to the last few weeks, I'm of course getting into a slight panic about what about my own writing. So I had intended to do a review of the recent exhibit in New York in the spring on the happenings. So I shipped up some material from New York City, some books and files, and I'm hoping that I might be able to get a short essay on that in the last month, now that I've got the journal out of the way, and I've just sent a book to our designer, so the book publishing is taken care of. So that's sort of the way it goes. But I've worked here a lot, and I've done a lot of projects and books. In the last 5 years, I finished a book of critical writings called Performance Histories. I edited a volume of plays from Europe called New Europe, post-1989 plays. So I found that I can work very well up here. And I'm able to pick up projects and drop them and pick them up again. I also use the Bard Library a lot. I'll go down there and work. And I use the Columbia Green Library just as space to work. Even though I have a whole house and I have a wonderful office and another reading room, I always have done this all my life. I go to another space. In New York City, I'll go to the NYU Library in my neighborhood. So I always go to another space and like to work on a big table with a lot of space around me and away from home to start a project. First of all, I have to say the computer changed the way I work, because up until the time I used a computer, I wrote everything longhand, and I really liked that, working that way, and then I would type it. Of course, it was an exhaustive process. I don't remember when I got onto the computer, probably during the 90s and the 2000s, so it's probably 20 years. I may be on the computer, my dates are a little bit iffy, but I wrote everything longhand. So, of course, it's much faster, you can do a lot more rewrites, and that's done quite a lot of, I mean, that's been very helpful for me. But as far as research, I just use it for fact-checking. I'm not a person who looks up keywords and, like, looks up articles. I like to go to the library and look at a book section, and I like to get my material from my own library. I have a very good library on contemporary arts, and so my seminars I make up from my library and the purchase of new books and DVDs and also my own research. And I keep extensive files, and they're all handwritten. Mm-hmm. All my school notes and all my files are handwritten. But as far as, you know, communication, business in Europe, all that has expanded so much in a career that, you know, I've been working over 35 years or so. When you start out after graduate school, you know, you don't know where you're going to go, and things expand, and you have more and more commitments abroad and more business and communication. So I'm getting things from all over the world. sent to me, and queries for the journal, and different kinds of invitations, especially from Europe. But the writing really was the leap from handwritten essays and retyping and over that, to the leap to the computer, and then the internet. And also I found that, it enhances my lectures and all that in terms of image research, and also doing PowerPoint programs and moving more toward visual ways of teaching and new styles of pedagogy and all of that. And developing more of a facility for podcasts, especially it's enhanced the publication of my journal so much, especially over the last year. You know, one used to do direct mail campaigns for subscriptions. Now it's all email campaigns and podcasts and getting onto websites and servers and listservs and all of that. So that has really changed a lot. And since you mentioned the computer, I'll just mention one thing. I have two studies. I have one room with my big desk and the file cabinet and my computer. And then I actually have fixed up another room, which is a study. It has a kind of 19th century desk that had a slot for a gas lamp. And I just bought some bookcases for that room, and I have a reading chair. And I sometimes use that room late at night, but I have a rule for that room that the computer is not allowed there, that I can only do work where it is handwritten, or it's editing where I have a pencil or a pen. And I've actually maintained that for 10 years.
And do you have different times of the day that you work in your different rooms? Or is there a sense of daily schedule? Mm-hmm. Or is that freeform?
Well, in New York City, I never work in the morning or early afternoon. I've always, all my professional life, go to the library at the end of the day after I spent a day in the publishing house office, and then I work day and night. And I frequently work till the middle of the night. I love the quietness and darkness of working on something in the middle of the night. But I'm trying to get away from staying up till 2, 3, or 4, uh-huh. And though I occasionally do. I don't observe that here upstate, but in the city I live that way sometimes. But it's true that I never write in the morning. I don't think I have ever written anything before mid-afternoon. What I do now is sometimes, against my better judgment, I'll get up and I'll go immediately to the computer, and before I know it, I've missed breakfast and lunch, and it's early afternoon, and I'm, you know, on email. Mm-hmm. And I don't really like that, but I kind of try to get the email out of the way. Reading, I read at night. I read in this other study. And I'll do editing there because I also like to print out articles and then correct them by hand, copy edit them by hand rather than on the computer. So I have this division of space for different times of day. I mean, I'm not obsessive about it, but I generally am not in the reading room at all during the day. And the computer is definitely never there. As I said, I've really maintained this separation for a good 10 years.
And does all your reading and fall into your interests that end up in your writing and in your career work? Or is there a whole kind of other world of interests that feed your professional work in a kind of corollary fashion or a supportive fashion? Mm-hmm.
Well, to go back to the first book I started talking about, the American garden writing, that grew out of my interest of working, you know, working for the first time as a gardener in the Hudson Valley. But it also led to a book of mine that came out in the mid-90s, which was called Ecologies of Theater. So that was a direct correlation where my interest in environment, site-specific works, ecology, resulted in that early work in my field of scholarship into ecology. And actually, that just led to my being recently invited to go to Finland in September, because there's a kind of a nature and the body and ecology big festival in Kuopio in Finland. So one goes they go back and forth and back and forth. I do spend a lot of time in Europe, and I like to read, you know, history books and books on foreign policy, and that results in my interest in the publishing house in plays in translation and work from abroad, and my own editing of that recent anthology, New Europe, this summer is usually when I can read novels and things that I can't read during the year. So I just picked up the other day, in fact I got it at Columbia Green, I saw it was a new book, the recent Nobel Prize winner, Herta Mueller. So I started reading her novel. She lives in Berlin, but she's Romanian, and I had just come back from Romania. I also recently read this book on climate change, Paul Gilding's book, The Great Disruption, mm-hmm. which Thomas Friedman wrote about in the New York Times. I read a fabulous book earlier in the summer, Kay Larson's book on John Cage and Buddhism called Where the Heart Beats. Now, that is connected to my work in terms of being involved in contemporary arts, but it was a time where I could just stop and read that biography. Then I was reading a travel book about this British famous travel writer, Patrick Freimore, who literally walked across the continent, of course taking some ferries and truck rides, mm-hmm. in 1933 on the eve of Hitler's rise to power. And he walked basically from taking the boat over from England all the way to around Croatia and Hungary. So I read a lot. I try to read a lot of books outside of my field, and the chance that I get to do those actually is mostly in New York. I mean, mostly in the Hudson Valley.
Are there any guilty pleasures to tie into all of this? You know, TV watching, or is it the pool? The pool.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I don't have my cable hooked up. I tried that about two or three summers, and it's worked really well, so that I have a kind of day shift to work in the yard and to get rid of a lot of email, and then swimming later afternoon and often reading magazines then, and then and having another shift at night when I'm home by not having the television. In fact, I decided I'm going to get my cable shut off in New York City after the elections, because I get so involved with watching these news shows for hours, and then I feel like I haven't accomplished anything at night, and they've been also all on the same topic, mm-hmm. you know. So I think I can do without television, and I really rather read, and I'm getting back to that. I've gotten away from doing all the reading that I like to do and in different fields and everything, because television just took over, and also I go to a lot of performances at night, so I don't have a lot of so-called free time. During the year, I'm working on my seminars and preparing them. I'm preparing that now, as a matter of fact, and then I have to prepare my talks for Finland, and meanwhile try to get an article started, mm-hmm. You know, work on the book publishing, the journal.
Thank you.
We are speaking with Bonnie Maranka here on the Work Show about the idea of a summer working vacation and how it fuels one's working life during the rest of the year.
So I have to say, I probably would describe myself as a workaholic. However, I take lots of free time for myself. I went to Europe for 4 or 5 weeks to various theater festivals, and I served on a jury at the New Romanian Drama Festival. And then I take a lot of walks in New York and try to find, you know, reading. So I'm not the type of person who never takes a vacation. I take several weeks away a year, and I also have really good time with friends and relaxation and having meals with people. And in fact, if somebody comes into the office or someone would drive up to my house or call me at night, I'm not the type of person who will, like, rush away and say, oh, I have this thing to do. I might drop something for hours and just go off with this person or have something spontaneously. So while I work a lot, because I love my work and it's all connected, the publishing, editing, writing, teaching, nevertheless, I feel really compelled to get out of the rat race of overproductivity that many Americans are stuck in, and I don't carry a cell phone. So, I'm just not obsessed with being connected all the time. I really like my solitude. I like to spend a lot of time with friends, and I don't want the computer and email and all of that to take over my life. I want to move more and more away from that.
And does it all balance itself monetary, financially? And has it always balanced itself? Or is that, because that's one of the, a lot of people think of work, and they think of work in terms of its financial equation. Mm-hmm. What it allows one. I mean, are there things that you want that you can't afford, or is it something that just all fits? And if so, how long did it take to kind of reach that point?
Well, I think I've been very lucky. If I just focus on the last 10 years, I would say having both the teaching job and the publishing house affords me enough income to be as comfortable as I want. I don't feel I need anything. I would like, what I need is more free time to travel. That's what I would do. I wouldn't work more. I wouldn't start more projects. I already love what I'm doing, but I would like more time to read and travel. So obviously if one is teaching, you are trapped in a place for 8 months, whereas you can more or less edit from a lot of different places now. So that's what I hope in the years to come, that I will have more time for myself. But I feel very lucky. I think a lot of it's the luck of the generations.
Explain a bit more on that.
Well, I think, you know, being of the 60s generation, where there seemed to be a whole sense of the freedom that you had as an individual, and people fairly well educated who went to school up until that time and had a lot of tools and resources and just a different mental attitude, and society was much more open. Of course, part of it was a feeling of utopianism in the sense of thinking that much more change and cultural innovation would come about. And I suppose it did in different ways, through feminism, through ecology, but I think that nobody at that time dreamed of the kind of corporate power that would be really dominating our lives now. So I'm very interested in forms of resistance to the way that American values have evolved, the way that American culture has evolved. On the other hand, I see with people in their 20s, for example, there just isn't that feeling of freedom. There's tremendous pressure in terms of where they feel they have to go to school, how much they're paying for school, not having jobs, and also being part of the arts world. Most of the younger artists, actually and older ones who are moving to New York, cannot live in Manhattan. The art scene that I came into in the 70s, when I was finishing graduate school and also working as a critic for the Soho Weekly News and the period when PAJ was founded in 1976. It was a tremendously exciting downtown art scene, and so many artists lived around the same places, frequented the same cafes. It was much cheaper to live, to go out to eat, to find space, and all that's changed so much now. It's hard to get published, it's hard to find a dance space, rehearsal space, it costs a lot to have a theater production. So, you know, there is a tremendous sense in this group of, I see, overwork, multiple jobs, not much time for just kind of sitting around with friends. Many of the cafes have disappeared. People live much farther. They have to commute farther to work. And even in terms of academia and scholarship, right away there's such a push for publication, conferences, all the kinds of things that I was free of when I was a graduate student. I could just go to the theater and read other things and research and do my own work. There wasn't the kind of pressure to enter the field so fast. Mm-hmm. I see with my students, they have such an anxiety, especially the ones in the visual arts, about the art market, about about their careers, about what they should do. It's a really troubling time, and not only from this country, but also having spent a lot of time every year in Europe, you can see that the whole continent is filled with people in their 20s and 30s who don't have a lot of work. It's difficult for jobs. It's difficult, especially in Eastern Europe, to move these older societies and transition since the fall of the Berlin Wall. I'm talking about people in the intellectual and cultural industries. I'm not speaking of people in computers and technology and engineering or science. I I'm not as sure in those fields, but I think they're also difficult with so many people losing their jobs now.
Have you seen speaking of that kind of longer vision, in the time that you've been up here in the Hudson Valley, how has it changed around you and around us in terms of both kind of the larger world and in this more specific world of kind of an intelligentsia, a world that values culture and art?
Well, I think in certain towns and regions, from what I've seen, there's been a tremendous uptick in culture. When I first got here, as I said, having the house since 1979, there was nothing that existed like Hudson, for example, in terms of all the galleries and the proliferation of restaurant culture. Saugerties was not in good shape at that time. Each town was different. Catskill was thriving. There were businesses open Friday nights, in the 80s, and there were several men's and women's clothing shops on the street, a butcher, shoemakers, gift shops, lots of restaurants. And now it's, you know, three bad winters with the economy, and one can see that it's really very difficult to maintain an economy, though there are many stirrings of arts groups, and the Greene County Arts Council has been so active in trying to establish Catskill as a destination for art and good conversation about the arts and the establishment of galleries. And of course, there's the Thomas Cole House, and there's Catwalk, the artist residency. But Hudson has become really central to the visual arts up in this area. I don't feel like a very strong sense of theater here, or of a performance scene, or literature. I think the performance scene is going to grow more with the art scene in terms of performance art. There's the Marina Abramovich Institute, which will open in the coming years. There's Basilica. I was the other day over in Philmont for the opening of the CR10 huge space, which is a performance and art space. I think after 9/11, many people moved up from New York, and people successively over the years are moving to this region because New York City is unaffordable, and so is rehearsal and art and studio space. But I regret the false economy here, the high prices, overpriced restaurants, and the two cultures that exist in Hudson. There's really two separate cultures in terms of the racial divide. I would like to see a much more mixed economy. You see that in Saugerties as well, too. So I'm afraid that's one of the negative things about bringing so much New York culture to these small towns.
Yeah. And just as the last thing, we'll probably be interrupted a little bit by, hope I just hit that. How did you end up where you are? Where did you start off from? And what was kind of your genesis to this present point?
You mean coming to this region?
Or just kind of from childhood?
All I can say is that I grew up in a family in which we all loved entertainment and singers and music, and we, during childhood, my father sang a lot. I took piano lessons from an early age. I grew up in New Jersey, and, at the time, as a young kid, watching television shows and becoming, at that time, absorbing a certain sense of performance styles, whether it was the old vaudeville performers or the great pop singers, beginning of rock and roll, the Ed Sullivan Show, all of the great television shows with singers, and many of the old performers who were still alive from burlesque and vaudeville. All I have to say is that I suppose I developed, without knowing it, a real love of performance styles and performance and serious artists. I also became, for my college paper, I started to develop an interest and became an editor there and started the drama and arts page at Montclair State. I think it's Montclair University now. And that's when I began to review works. And I switched my major from being a Latin major to going into speech and theater, which were connected in those days. And then I got out of that because I was never really interested in performance. I was only always interested in writing about art. And then I went into the English department where I studied drama and dramatic literature. And I began coming into New York a lot and writing reviews for my college paper and then moving to New York in 1971, then going to graduate school in New York and constantly going to performances and then going to Europe. Over the decades, and writing for the Soho Weekly News. So by the time that I was finishing up, or I was leaving my doctoral studies, another student whom I had met and then married, we decided to start this arts journal because there was so much great activity in New York in the mid-70s. And we were becoming friends with the artists in this downtown avant-garde arts world, as well as having the academic credentials and the ties to translators and scholars. So we put those two things together to create PAJ. And that's really basically where I started. Though when I was in New York, I was actually, in my early days, a music critic. I wrote about early jazz, and I wrote and interviewed a lot of pop singers. I wrote for Stereo Review and Modern Hi-Fi and Music and Downbeat and Crawdaddy and Rolling Stone. So I have to say, I was probably always, without realizing it, interested very much in journalism. And I first got in through off-Broadway performances and then started doing a lot of music and then got into the avant-garde theater scene. And I just was very lucky in finding my way early. And As I said, I really love my work, and I've always loved it. And even now, editing my 102nd issue, I'm always very excited about having a voice, an international voice in the culture. I feel it's very valuable as a point of resistance to what's happened in the media with regard to serious coverage of the arts or the shrinkage in newspapers. And PAJ is a voice in the curriculum and a resource for artists, and I just love having a journal to edit.
And what drew you up here into the Hudson Valley instead of, say, off into Connecticut or back down to New Jersey?
Interestingly enough, there would be these festivals in Catskill called August Moon, run by Rick Zank, who was a founder of the Iowa Theater Lab, which first grew out of, first based in Iowa, or maybe it was based at the university. So Rick had these gatherings of all these fascinating theater artists and groups come up from the city and maybe from other places back in the 70s, and it was called August Moon. And it would be on Cotterskill Road, and we'd all be put up there and living there. So, you know, my husband and I came up, and we got to know the area, and then we just on a whim we thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a property here and or a house here? And it was just purely by chance. That's how I landed up in this area.
She said, "It looks. Don't you think it looks a lot like rain?" Isn't it just like a woman? She said, "It's hard. It's just hard. It's just kind of hard to say." He said, goes that way. he said. Isn't it? Isn't it just like a woman? She said, it takes one to know one. He said, isn't it just like a woman? She said it to know. She said it to no one. Isn't it just like a woman? Today's work, to look into them. Your eyes, today's work, just looking into them.
This is The Work Show, and we are speaking today with Bonnie Marenka of Catskill about the idea of a working vacation.
And then just to kind of to close out, you know, I realize it should be addressed. You were also very involved with Free 103.9, the mother organization for this radio station.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yes, I was president of the board of directors for 2 years, and I think on the board for another year. I just left that position the year before. So I was able to be part of that organization, you know, early on in its development. And in fact, my publishing house published their book, Transmission Arts. We did that in association with each other. I've been very much involved with them. In fact, we're planning this convening in October, mid-October, at Wave Farm in Accra. And maybe another book will come out of it, but it will certainly be streamed live or archived on their website. And that's going to be organized with maybe a dozen people come to talk about pretty much the state of transmission arts, which could include internet or radio or work in galleries, anything that's broadcast over the airwaves. You'll talk about media justice, about utopian ideas, about new technologies, different kinds of content, text. So that's something that's coming right up, as I said, in mid-October. And WGXC also recorded that recent John Cage event that many of us attended down at Bard College and sponsored by the John Cage Trust. Also the author of the book I mentioned, Kay Larson. There was a 12-hour event, and we all brought our sleeping gear and slept in the Spiegel tent while we heard a rare recording of Cage's Empty Words, his piece from the mid-70s. So WGXC was there as well. So yes, I've been very interested in all kinds of new arts, and I was asked to be on the board, and so it worked out very well for a couple of years.
Did you ever expect a radio station of this sort to be playing in this area that has meant so much to your life?
No, it was really kind of a surprise. I wasn't aware until I met Galen Joseph Hunter and Tom Rowe about the whole question of piracy and local radio stations and certain governmental acts that freed the airwaves. I certainly was aware of what's been happening with the shutdown of really countercultural or alternative radio stations by just seeing what's happened to the ones in New York. I mean, so many of the radio stations have gone off the air. The pervasiveness of right-wing talk shows we see now, and the hard struggle of classical music and many different kinds of programs or alternative works. So it's really amazing that I think they're probably going into their third year now, mm-hmm. and to have that up here. I've actually done a couple of things with them. We had a dialogue with Barbara Moore, who has a tremendous archive as a scholar and artist, and the widow of Peter Moore, of performance photos from the downtown scene. We had a conversation. And I'm also going to be having a few conversations with some other local people in the future.
And just to close out, from your own work experience and this kind of route that has taken you into this kind of perfect meshing of interests and work, what lessons would you pull out of it for listeners, for other people who are kind of struggling with jobs that they don't like or trying to figure out where their career is going to go or how to make it work? How does one make it work?
I do from time to time talk to people who have these concerns or who are struggling mainly with trying to do their own serious work and also how to make a living in New York City. I think it helps to maybe live out of the city, but it depends on what kind of career you want, what field you're in, what your affordability is, what your needs are to have a family. It's very difficult to have a family and kids being in the arts. But I always say to people that they just simply have to do what they really love. You really can't decide where there are openings or what is the cool profession or what seems to be needing people to move into that area and base your career on that. In a way, you, in many of the arts areas, you simply have to invent your own career or invent yourself. You have to do many things. I know now with students and all that, instead of just studying skills or crafts, for example, I think it's important to learn curating, to learn archiving, to learn producing, to become more and more independent. But I'm not sure how a lot of blogs and work on the web will produce the money that people need to live. I just simply think that one has to, it's very difficult, one has to be adept at fundraising. It's important to develop social skills, to be with groups of people whom you can work with. That's always been the case with different generations, that they've all gotten together and produced their own work and been very independent. But really the main thing is, as I said, you can't wait for some career to happen. But also you don't have to imagine your entire future now. I think a lot of people get too goal-oriented and try to project too much into the future, either from parents or friends or the art market or the university or whatever, who pushes people into a kind of careerism too early. I think that's creating a great amount of anxiety. People work at different stages, they're always evolving at different times of their lives, but I think it's very important to mostly only do what you really love and try to do as few things as possible that you don't like to do.
Mm-hmm. And go swimming. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Work Show, our August edition. For today's music, we listen to Philip Glass's grand opera, Einstein on the Beach, in its opener, Nie One. We heard a production of John Cage's Sonata No. 5. We heard Think from Lester Bowie's Brass Fantasy. We heard Vaz featuring Marko Markovic from the Boban Markovic Orchestra. We heard the IT Tango from Laurie Anderson. And we heard Lonely Woman from the wonderful Ornette Coleman Quartet. Until next month, keep on working.